Coming up in this episode. So that's why I picked up this book. I wanted to understand why they were such a cultural touchstone.
First of all, sounds incredibly difficult to work with these guys.
They managed to make the mainstream bend in their direction rather than the other way around.
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections, hosted by two of your favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Peter Biello.
And I'm Orlando Montoya. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own thoughts and ideas on just what gives these works the narrative edge. All right, Peter, I'm going to start with a hypothetical question.
All right, let's hear it.
So let's assume this podcast gets way big. We're talking huge. Millions of dollars, like we are rolling in it.
Okay.
And it's made us completely rich and famous.
I mean, that's what I thought going in.
Well, the catch is now that we're owned by some big corporation that's giving us all this money, we can't interview who we want to interview. We have to sort of perform the way other people want us to perform. We have to sell out.
Our corporate overlords will control our lives.
Would you sell out?
Hell yeah.
All right.
Everybody's got a price, man. Everyone's got a price.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because the book that we're going to talk about today, the central premise of it is that the members of REM are not sellouts.
Okay.
That the famous Athens alternative rockers have held true to their roots. They've held true to their alternative spirit. They've held true to themselves. And they are not a sellout. They're a great band. The book is called The Name of This Band is REM by Peter Ames Carlin.
Well, first of all, I love a good music conversation with you. This is not the first one.
And especially a group from sort of my age bracket. You know, we're both of the age that we should know REM.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I come into this conversation knowing REM, a few songs by them, and there's a guy named Michael Stipe in the band who's a big deal.
Well, I never disliked their music, but I never liked it either. I was kind of like, maybe I like their hits, right?
Yeah,
I know their hits. I like their hits. I can see their superstardom, but I never really understood it. So that's why I picked up this book. I wanted to understand why they were such a cultural touchstone, why they were so great.
The overarching achievement of REM was their ability to confound expectation and to confound the demands of, you know, the culture and the industry, and be able to say, we don't do it that way. We do it this whole other way. And not only get away with it, but B, you know, transform the culture and change the way that it was done.
Well, there's a lot of unpack there in that little bite. But from the very beginning of the book, Peter Ames Carlin argues that in many ways, REM succeeded in spite of themselves because they were so alternative and so non-mainstream. Their music didn't fit into any of the neat categories of the early 80s.
Yeah, so we're talking early 80s through the 90s. That's when I became aware of them, in the early 90s. So what, I mean, he talks about them being sort of against the grain. What was the grain at the time?
Well, this was the music of the early 80s. So what, that music is punk, right? That music is hard rock. It's new wave. It's glam rock. And back then, they kind of delighted in coming out with records that did not fit into any of those categories. There was, you know, they talked about, well, that they would get their records and the record stores didn't know where to put them. And then, of course, there's Michael Stipe's lyrics. He kind of mumbled the lyrics. The lyrics were always kind of hard to understand. And the lyrics were kind of mysterious and oblique anyway. So from the music side, they were kind of misunderstood, right? And then they weren't understood from kind of like the hit-making promotional habits of them.
Yeah, so songs like Losing My Religion, for example, not super easy to understand or categorize. It's a vibe, you like it, but what is this about, really?
Well, we haven't even gotten to Losing My Religion.
Okay, we're going to get to that, I guess.
We're starting, like, back in the 80s. They started in 1980, as you may know, in Athens, Georgia. They were college students and college dropouts in some cases. They're just guys who wanted to form a band and play good music. But then they when they started to, you know, have shows and even have a record contract, they had all these promotional habits that really worked against them.
What do you mean promotional habits?
Well, for a long time, Stipe didn't like being interviewed. As the front man, that's kind of expected. You're the one who's supposed to go out and answer the questions. But he didn't like doing that. And there's the example of their first national TV appearance on Letterman, when they go on David Letterman and the guys come out there and perform their song. And then Michael Stipe goes, hides in the back, and the other bandmates are left to answer the question.
Thank you, folks. Welcome back. This is REM, Peter Buck. Nice job, Peter. Nice meeting you, sir.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sorry, your name again, sir? Mike, nice to see you, sir.
So Michael Stipe didn't like being interviewed, and for a long time they refused to shoot music videos that were anything that their record company or MTV wanted. There were these music videos where, do you remember any of them? These sort of weird ones that were kind of upside down, black and white, brush pictures, you know. And their music label is saying, you know, give us a video that we can get on MTV. And they're saying, no, we don't want to do it. And they didn't appear on their album covers. Michael Stipe said, I'm not lip syncing to lyrics on the videos. And they, even when they got big and famous, they refused to promote some of their biggest albums by going out on tour. And this went on for a long time.
Didn't last forever, obviously. First of all, sounds incredibly difficult to work with these guys. They must have really liked their music to stay committed to people who seem so hard to work with. But when they did these things, the things that they previously refused to do, is that when they were accused of selling out, when they finally made the music videos that I ended up seeing in the 90s, for example?
Absolutely. But the author's take on it is, what were they supposed to do? They wanted their way to become mainstream, and it did.
They were going to take their sound and their art and their ideals to this broad population. And I don't think that they thought from the beginning or that they understood exactly how to do that or what that was going to look like or feel like. But, you know, they just figured they would walk down that road and see how far they got before either they hit a dead end or they just couldn't tolerate it anymore. But as it turned out, you know, they were exceptionally gifted at being able to appeal to the mainstream without distorting their, you know, themselves and their artistry in order to appeal to the mainstream. They managed to make the mainstream bend in their direction rather than the other way around.
So in other words, they hit the sweet spot. They could have the best of both worlds.
According to the author, yes.
According to the author,
I mean, there are some people who thought they did sell out, you know, and the author does get into some of that criticism, but I didn't know a lot of their music before I read this book, and what I did was, as the book was going along, and the author talked about a particularly important song, or a song that kind of sounded like it was represented a change, or it was very important, I went and I listened to it. Right. I'm not going to tell you I listened to their entire catalog, but I listened to sort of the important songs, the important albums. And I said, you know what? I don't think they did change. They remained the same sort of weird way the whole way through. And, you know, so I think that he was probably right in their assessment. Now, we'll get to some of their other more controversial points later. But I think that for the bottom line, I don't think they can be accused of selling out music-wise.
Okay. Well, there must be a few other REM books out there. What makes this one different from those?
Well, again, I haven't read all of the other REM books, but Peter Ames Carlin did, and this is how he answers that question. And I should note here that Carlin also has written books about Bruce Springsteen, Paul Simon, and Brian Wilson, among others.
A lot of the people that I've written about have already had books written about them. But for me, the question is there the book that I want to read about this person or about, this artist? And in this case, you know, one of the things that was interesting to me was that the books that did exist about REM, certainly the narrative biographies, had all been written by British writers. And they're great. They're fine. I mean, and were focused specifically on the music and the music industry, which is terrific. That's a great way to write about artists like this. But I was interested in REM as not just as musicians and artists and successful pop stars, but also in what they represented and achieved in a cultural context.
Okay, so what does he mean by that? Explaining REM in a cultural context.
Well, there's a lot in the book about the political and social atmosphere of the 1980s and 1990s that relates to REM's career. The most obvious one is Michael Stipe's sexuality. Is he bi? Is he gay? Is he queer? What are we going to call him? You know, he dresses in a non-gender-conforming way sometimes. Then there's Rock the Vote. You remember Rock the Vote?
I remember the effort, yeah.
So, yeah, they wanted to get motor voter laws passed, and then MTV came up with this big campaign that ultimately was successful. And REM was a big part of Rock the Vote. The book also goes into a lot of placing REM within the musical cultural context of the scene around Athens, the South, and the nation. There's a lot of bands in here I don't know.
Okay. So, does that take away from the story?
That was the weakest aspect of the book, in my opinion. If I did have one criticism, I don't think I need an extended passage about Bill Clinton or Tipper Gore. You know, I was there. What propels this book forward for me and what kept me reading was I know where the story is going. I know that REM is going to get super huge, and I know that they're going to fall. But how are we going to get there? Will there be drama between band members? Will there be bad behavior? Yes and yes. It's a band.
Can I ask, did the band talk to the author?
No. So actually, that was also something that I might have liked, but maybe not. I mean, the author had his own take on that subject.
It's always disappointing when you set out to write about someone and they don't want to cooperate. But on the other hand, it can also, that kind of a little bit of distance can give you a different and in some ways more clear perspective on them, because you're hearing from their friends and family, you're hearing from the people they worked with. And also, you know, with a band like REM that was so successful for so long, you know, there's just so much printed material tracking the way that they felt about their work and their career and their lives contemporaneously from moment to moment to moment. And I could find and read and absorb all of that stuff. You know, in some ways that becomes a more important story anyway, because that's how the audience has perceived them. And that's what's important is, you know, the creation of the work itself, and how the work affects the people who, you know, who hear it.
Yeah, so that's basically his take on that.
So it sounds like he's sort of making hay of the situation that he has, but ideally you'd want to talk to them, right? You want to get a sense of, this happened. What do you recall about when this happened?
Well, and then I get the sense from the book that at this point, REM are just like done with everything. They're retired. They're doing their art projects, and they don't really want to have to do anything with the band anymore.
Oh, yeah. Even their royalties, too, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
Just forget all about those.
So, I mean, and another thing about the book that I like is that he kind of drops little hints about where things are going and where we've been to kind of remind us the story. So it really is superbly written that way. I mean, how many times in this book does he mention the birthday party at the former church?
Really? What is that?
That's where they all began in 1980. It was a birthday party in a former church building that had been converted into student housing off campus. And so they took it over and had a birthday party. And everything after that kind of gets weighed against that moment.
Hmm. The ultimate act of counterculture, having some blasphemous music in a former church.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was one thing that I liked about the book, the way he wrote it. And another thing was just learning all about the hits, you know, all about those songs that I knew, Shiny Happy People, Stand. Shiny Happy People.
Stand in the place where you live. Now things know. Think about direction.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
big one.
Losing My Religion.
That one in the corner.
That's me in the corner.
Song that was their biggest hit, Losing My Religion, is like one of the weirdest songs to ever hit the top 40, let alone, you know, the top two, which, you know, and to sell a million copies, which it did in 1991, because at a time when music was so overwhelmingly electronic and synthesized and sleek, here was a song that was not only featured a mandolin as its lead instrument, but also, you know, a lyric that was, you know, that played like a set of riddles, you know, that was almost in code, because Michael was using an anachronistic Southern expression, losing my religion, to describe these feelings of being out of control and in a love affair that was, you know, overwhelming and frustrating and painful and beautiful at the same time.
Okay, so as the resident Yankee of this podcast, I have to admit, I didn't know losing my religion was a Southern expression.
I didn't know that either.
Okay, well, if you don't know, I feel less bad about it.
Well, and he's talking in codes like throughout his song. I
mean, yes.
He is the master of the mysterious lyric.
Okay, so back to the central question of selling out. The author doesn't think they sold out, but what about you, someone who's not a fan?
Oh, you know, I'll go easy on them. They changed their mind. They changed their mind. When new information came to be, they changed their mind. Everybody gets to change their mind, but I will say there was a point in the book where I stopped rooting for them.
Oh, really? Okay, this sounds interesting to me.
Well, it was...
What was that point?
Well, you know, they start out, they're this scrappy band, they're going across the country in a van. And I mean, they're always nice people, but there comes a point in the book where they're now in 5 buses and they now have jets and they're now, you know, have levels of backstage passes. And they now are having contracts that specify what alcohol and food is to be in the concert venue.
Hmm.
And they're complaining about being famous. Oh, I'm famous. Meanwhile, they're hanging out with A-list celebrities in Hollywood. And that's the point where I'm kind of like, you know what? I'm not rooting for them anymore.
But isn't that the way with so many bands, right? You know, the success gets to their head in a way, and their music changes as a result. Did you feel like the music changed when they got that way, or did they maintain?
I don't think the music changed. I mean, from a strictly non, you know, fan point of view, I think it's the same weird as now as it was back then.
Mm.
You know, I think other critics, and he points this out in the book, other critics do find changes that some would call selling out. But me, I'm, I didn't connect to it, so I kind of think it's the same weird it was before.
Well, that's fascinating. Awesome story then. Thanks so much for sharing this. The book is called The Name of This Band is R.E.M. by Peter Ames Carlin. This is great. Thanks, Orlando.
Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to Narrative Edge. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode. This podcast is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Find us online at gpb.org/narrativeedge.
You can also catch us on the daily GPB news podcast, Georgia Today, for a concise update on the latest news in Georgia. For more on that and all of our podcasts, go to gpb.org/podcasts.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.